Welcome to Canary in a Cornfield, a podcast from the Harkin Institute for Public Policy and Citizen Engagement, where we explore how the policies that shape our food and farming systems impact our health, our communities, and our future. As most of our listeners probably know, the Harkin Institute was founded upon the retirement of longtime public servant and Iowa legend Tom Harkin, in order to continue doing high-quality work on the policy issues that were important to him. The Harkin Institute advances inclusive, evidence-based public policy by connecting research, civic learning, and lived experience, and we provide access to high-quality information, empower active community participation, and help ensure transparent political processes. My role at the Harkin Institute is Director of Wellness and Nutrition. And I was really thrilled last year when I had an opportunity to host a conference at the Harkin Institute focused on industrial farm animal production, the environment, and public health, coinciding with a book on those topics being co-edited by Robert Martin from the Johns Hopkins Center for a Livable Future and Dr. James Merchant from the University of Iowa. That conference helped set us down a road where we examine the connection between agriculture and public health more closely, and this podcast is intended to help share some of those connections with a wider audience by interviewing experts on different topics from around the United States and across the world. And who better to have on our first podcast than the man himself, Senator Tom Harkin. Senator Harkin has had a huge impact on policy in the United States. Almost anywhere you go in the country, you can see some of that impact if you look closely enough. Just to name a few examples, he was the co-author of the American Disabilities Act. He led efforts to include preventative health care in the Affordable Care Act via the Prevention and Public Health Services Fund. He led efforts to pass the DSHEA Act, which is the Dietary Supplement Health and Education Act, which shapes how supplements and nutraceutical industry is governed. He oversaw the passage of two farm bills, and he was responsible for legislation funding the provision of fresh fruits and vegetables in schools and incentivizing agricultural lands being used for conservation, as you will hear more about in the podcast very soon. As someone who's been fortunate to work with Senator Harkin, it's incredible to see the impact he's had on so many people's lives, in no small part because of his efforts in the areas of agriculture and public health. Whenever I'm out in public with him, people recognize him on the street and generally have some story to share about how they worked with him or thanking him for something important he did. So it's really a wonderful gift to be able to see that in person. If you would like to stay abreast of all the developments at the Harkin Institute, please visit our page at harkininstitute.drake.edu or visit some of our social media sites. And you can find the home of this podcast by going to Canary in a Cornfield at Substack. So with no further ado, let's start the interview with Senator Tom Harkin. Senator Harkin, thank you so much for joining us for the first official podcast of the Wellness and Nutrition Program at the Harkin Institute. We're just really thrilled to be able to start out with you speaking, first of all.
Well, Adam, thank you. It's an honor to be here with you and delight to be the first on your podcast. And again, I just thank you for doing this because it's another way of the Harkin Institute reaching out to people around the state to involve the community at large in what's going on at the Institute and to keep people informed, but also to have a way for people to interact with the Institute. So thank you for doing this.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm so thrilled and honored to be a part of the Institute, and I'm really excited to see where this goes. So as you know, the podcast is focused on the connection between agriculture and public health, and your career was defined in part by making really big contributions in both of those areas. So I was especially interested if you could say a little bit more about how you initially got involved in health and wellness. We'll talk a little bit about some of your many contributions there, but how did that issue become such a big focus in your congressional and Senate career?
Well, when I first went to Congress in 1975, I was not on the Health Committee. I was on the Agriculture Committee. And in fact, in my 40 years in Congress and the Senate, I served on the Ag Committee for 40 years. But when I first got into Congress, some things happened in my family. I had two sisters who both died within a year and a half of each other of breast cancer. They lived in small towns. They didn't have the best health care available. I had another brother who had thyroid cancer, I had a nephew who was injured and became paraplegic. And, this got me thinking about the medical system in America and healthcare system in America. And then as I continued on in agriculture, it became apparent that there was a lot of things happening in rural America closely connected to agriculture that had something to do with how healthy we are. Later, that developed into things that, like, the kind of food we eat, the kind of food we grow, the kind of agricultural systems we have. So it was an evolutionary thing for me over the first few years. And then after that, I really got heavily involved in nutrition and health. And as you know, one of the parts of the annual, not annual, every 4 or 5 year farm bill is a nutrition section of the farm bill. So nutrition was a big deal in doing our farm bills. And I began to pay close attention to that in the beginning, basically in what was called the food stamp program at that time, and later now called SNAP, Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. But in those days, it was who, not only who was eligible for food stamps, but what could they get? What kind of food could they get in food stamps? And so I began to get involved in the nutritional aspects of agriculture at that time.
Yeah, that sounds great. And that anticipates a little bit my next question. So we asked about the health side. I was also going to ask about your interest in agriculture. Is that something that just kind of assumed that any representative from Iowa is going to be involved in agriculture? Was that something that you had a passion for even before joining Congress and the Senate?
Well, I was not raised on a farm. I was raised in a small rural community. And of course, we always had a garden. We kept animals. We had our own dairy cow. We always raised a few pigs, that type of thing. Chickens, did our own eggs. So we always, my mother canned every year, we had a huge orchard. We always had fresh fruit, vegetables. My mother would can them and that's what we'd have during the winter time. So my interest, well, I guess when I first went to Congress, if it was in agriculture, it was sort of in that kind of agriculture. But then I represented Iowa, and I represented a district that was very heavy into large-scale farming. And so I then began my interest in agriculture support programs and how they work. And at a very, very early time, around 1977, I joined with another congressman from Minnesota to propose a different system of agriculture support for the farm commodity programs. Since the Great Depression, there's been support from the federal government for what we call program crops that were in the program. Well, what were they? Well, corn, cotton, tobacco, rice, sugar. Soybeans were not in at that time. They came in later, much later. There weren't that many soybeans. Oh, wheat, of course, wheat. Oh, wheat, yeah. Wheat was in the program. So they were program crops. What the federal government and the senators and representatives needed was to make sure that we had enough production to meet our export needs, plus make sure we had, I think the term at that time was called an ever-normal granary, so that we had enough stockpiles so that people wouldn't go hungry, that we would have carryovers. But then we didn't want too much carryover because that would depress prices. So you had to balance that. And we had a supply control program in agriculture from the Depression through probably, I would say, up until maybe the 90s. So that was the system. And as I said, if I might digress just a little bit, one of the things that always bothered me from the beginning was this, that the bigger you were as a farmer, the more support and subsidies you got.
Yeah.
Well, that seemed to me in 1977, I said, I joined with this other congressman, and we proposed a radical different approach. What we advocated was that for the first so many bushels or pounds, in case of cotton, you would get a very high support price. For the next increment of 1,000 bushels or pounds or whatever, you would get less of a support price. For the next increment, you'd get even less until there was a point where you produced so much, you didn't get any support beyond that. You were just on the market. You had to rely upon the market after that. Well, we didn't get very far with that. The big farms and the big farmers, no. So what happened is the federal government, because of the very nature of its agricultural support programs, actually encouraged and promoted farms to get bigger.
Get bigger, get out, right?
Well, and Errol Butz, former Secretary of Agriculture, said that, get bigger or get out. That was his philosophy. Well, it was nuts. I mean, because what happened was, if you were a big farmer, you got more subsidy, you got more support, therefore you got more money, and you could outbid other people for your neighbor's land. Well, you got that. Well, now you got even more. You got even more subsidy, so you could bid and buy even more land. And it just became a black hole of sucking in more and more money so farmers could get bigger and bigger and bigger. And you see what we wound up with today: huge monoculture farms.
Sounds like a great proposal. Has anyone picked that up since?
No, no,
Don't suppose there's much hope of
no.
reviving it in the near term.
I don't think we get it revived, but well, there should be the spin-off of that now. What I've been advocating the last many years is that we need to shift some of our support, program crops. Well, fruits and vegetables were never a program crop. So in the 2002 Farm Bill, when I was chair of the Ag Committee in the Senate, for the first time, we involved fruits and vegetables. And now they are a part, not in terms of a subsidy, but in terms of a support mechanism for fruits and vegetables. The idea, of course, now, what I would be proposing would be that we use the federal government to support and sustain small, less intensive, maybe more organic or more healthful types of food production systems. Just take an example. They always say, well, one of the problems we have in Iowa with fruits and vegetables, we have long winters. Well, yeah, that's true. But we could also build a lot of greenhouses, and we could use solar energy and wind energy, which we have in abundance, to provide the heat and water for greenhouses. And sure, it is more expensive than planting a garden in the summer. That's right. But you could provide those kinds of fruits and vegetables at a time when the demand is high and in the wintertime, and there could be a source of income. So yeah, it would be a support mechanism. It would be us saying as a society, we think it's valuable to have diversified agriculture. We think it's valuable for small farmers to be able to grow these kinds of healthy foods and to have access to a market for those, not just in the summer at farmers markets, but during the winter in grocery stores and other places like that.
Yeah, that sounds fantastic. And I've heard from a lot of sources that there's a multitude of reasons to want to have more diversified crop production in Iowa. And one of the things I heard was that with the changing rain patterns because of climate change, California is not going to be able to grow as many fruits and vegetables in the future. And so there might be more of a burden on other states to pick up some of that.
That's true. And our winters are not as severe as they used to be either. So the amount of the heat that you have to produce and warmth and that type of thing. And we know better on how to build greenhouses that are much cheaper than they were in the past. So yeah, we can do this. It's not much of a stretch to think about what we could be doing here in Iowa. We have the soil. We have water. If it's not river water, it's alluvial wells that we have. The Jordan Aquifer under much of the state of Iowa produces enough water for that type of agriculture. And we're in the center of the United States, so our delivery to big markets. I mean, you go from California to the East Coast, that's a lot of transportation, a lot of energy. Much cheaper to go from Iowa to the East Coast or to Chicago or any place like that. So we are in a good position to do that, but we're so locked into mono agriculture, corn and beans, corn and beans, corn and beans. And quite frankly, it's hurting us in water quality, and I think health too. You talk about health. I think it's causing some big health problems in this state.
Yeah, that leads me to my next question. Zooming out a little bit, what's your view of the overall state of health in the United States? And what do you think are some of the biggest things that need to be fixed? And how do you see the food system fitting into all of this?
Well, overall, for the United States, I've been fond of saying this, Adam, that if you get sick, or if you have an injury or an accident or something like that, there's probably no better place to be in the world than the United States. We can patch and fix and mend just about anything. I just had a new shoulder put in about a year ago. My wife had a knee put in. I mean, and cancer, if you get cancer, probably no better place to be than here in America. We're great at remediation. If, however, you want to stay healthy, probably one of the worst places in the world is the United States of America. We are so bad in how we work to keep people healthy in the first place. It has to do with our food production system and distribution. It has to do with the overabundance of starches, fats, and sugars that people eat. And again, that goes back to, what are we growing? Corn for high fructose corn syrup, which is in everything. It's in about every food you ever buy, and on our diets, and just the access to healthy food in America. It's very tough, very, very hard to get access to that. Now we've tried to change that in some of our farm bills, like the Healthy Hunger Free Kids Act that I basically did in 2010. Other things to try to change at least how our young people get access to more healthy food. So the state of health in America is, it's easy to be unhealthy and hard to be healthy. It should be the other way around. It should be hard to be unhealthy and easy to be healthy.
You've touched on this a little bit already with the Fresh Fruits and Vegetables program, but can you say more about, as you were the chairman of the Senate Agriculture Committee, you had a platform to look at different policies and what goes into the whole food system in the US. What did you try to accomplish when you were seeing through the passage of some of the farm bills and leading that committee?
Well, what I wanted to do was to get fruits and vegetables involved. And when I got the chairmanship, I only had it for a brief time, I think 2000, 2001, and lost the election in 2002. So I had it just for, what, 2 years. But I was able to put the first fresh fruit and vegetable snack program in for schools. And we did it on an experimental basis. We took four or five states, I think 4 states maybe. And Iowa was one of them. Iowa, Ohio, Michigan, and forget the other state now. And to see how this would work. Well, for the next 4 or 5 years, I kept it alive because I was on the Appropriations Committee, so I kept the program going. And it became very successful in those 4 states in schools. And then a couple of other states learned about it and they wanted in it. And so we were able to get some more money in appropriations, and we extended it to, I know, Mississippi, and then to Pennsylvania and a couple of other states. So by the time I got my chairmanship back in 2007, after the 2006 election, I was able to take that program, which we'd kept alive, and expand it and embed it, and now it's in every state in the nation. We changed it somewhat. We learned from mistakes. We made mistakes. One mistake was doing it in high schools. Well, that didn't work. So we limited only to elementary schools, and we gave a preference to schools that have a higher incidence of free and reduced price lunches. In other words, poor kids going to school. But it's been a great success. It's just is not being funded very much. So here we have this new Secretary of Health, Robert Kennedy, talking about healthful lifestyles and healthful food and better food in schools. I'm saying, yes, but you're defunding the very program that I started to get more fresh fruit and vegetables into schools. That doesn't make sense.
Was it a challenge to keep the program alive? Were there moments where people were trying to kill off the program,
Oh,
or?
oh yeah. Oh yeah. Well, yes, under the Bush administration, after I'd started the program, of course, as I said, I lost the chairmanship and we lost control and we lost the, they had, we had a new different Secretary of Agriculture come in. And their philosophy was, again, corn and beans and wheat and cotton, rice, that type of sugar. Just focus on that. But as I said, I was on ag appropriation, so I was able to keep enough money to keep it alive. But they kept trying to kill it by defunding it, but I had enough seniority and power then that I could keep it going. The other thing they tried to do was to kill it by broadening it. Well, here's what.
Including other,
Well, see, I had fresh fruits and vegetables. Well, all of a sudden the canned fruits wanted in. And you know what is in that canned fruit? 90% sugar. And so a lot of my friends on the other side of the aisle said, oh, well, let's let the canned fruits in. That's a good way to kill it. And then the nut people wanted in. They wanted to get nuts in the program. Well, quite frankly, tree nuts are pretty helpful. I mean, if you have walnuts, almonds, pistachios, cashews, Brazil nuts, macadamia nuts, those tree nuts are helpful. However, guess who really wanted in was the peanut people,
No.
which is not very helpful. And I said to people in the walnut industry, in that walnut business, look, if you get in, you're going to be drowned out by the peanut people. They have more power. They've got people on the ag committee from those peanut states, and that's what kids will be eating. They'll be eating salted peanuts. So I was able to keep that out too. So I kept out all the canned and, oh, frozen. Oh, then they wanted canned fruits, frozen fruits, and that type of thing in it.
Wow, they tried everything, it sounds
They
like.
tried every way, but it survived and it's doing fairly well now. It needs to be funded better. There are a lot of schools that are not in the program that could be in the program and should be in the program, should be in every elementary school, but it's not. I will say this, though, it's in probably, I don't know if my figure's right, but I would say 80 to 90% of the elementary schools in America that have over 50% of their kids on free and reduced price lunches are in this program, in the fresh fruit and vegetable snack program. And it's well documented. Kids love that fruit, and a lot of times they take it home with them because they don't get it at home. They don't get fresh apples or fresh pears or fresh grapes and things like that at home, so they take it home for their siblings.
Sure. Yeah, that makes sense. One more question on this topic. Just I was curious from a personal level, just because I hear so much about how big and complicated the Farm Bill is. When you first got put in charge of seeing through the Farm Bill, were you shocked at how much complexity was involved in that, or were you prepared to?
Well, I don't know that I was prepared for it. No, I learned on the job. I mean, I guess when I first got on the Ag Committee, it was just the first thing that hit me was how agriculture was geared towards these program crops and how they were subsidized. As I said, the bigger you are, the more you got. That just didn't make sense to me from any kind of a standpoint. And then the nutrition part, the food stamps. People are always after food stamps, fraud, waste, and abuse. Do you think that's a new thing today? No, after fraud, waste, and abuse in the food stamp program at that time. Well, it can always be modifications and changes made to make sure things work a little bit better, of course. But in all my years on the Ag Committee and dealing with nutrition and food stamps and now the SNAP program, we've done so many different investigations and assessments of the program and had different firms come in, private firms come in and do an accounting of what was going on. I think in all those years, I know I'm not far off in saying that the amount of waste or fraud, I don't know what abuse means, but waste and fraud was always 1% or less. It's just, that was it. There's always somebody trying to jiggle something someplace, but you catch them and you stop it. And then somebody else has a different idea on how to game the system. But it has always been less than 1%. And then what really got to me early on agriculture was the power of the big commodities, the corn lobby, the wheat lobby, the sugar, rice, and at that time tobacco. Now later we got off of tobacco. We were able to extricate from tobacco. But just the power that they had to basically get what they wanted first in the agriculture bill, and then what might be left for others, like fruits and vegetables or beginning farmer programs or the whole organic movement. It was actually my amendment on a farm bill that allowed farmers to shift to organics. And here was the problem, Adam. In order to get organic certification, you had to go, I think it was 3 or 4 or 5 years, I forget now, of no pesticides and no herbicides on any of your ground for I think it was 3 years. And then you could start growing crops and get them certified as organic. We always called that the Valley of Death because if you shifted from that and stopped putting on your pesticides and herbicides and nitrogen, your yield went way down.
Oh, right.
So your yield went down, so you didn't get as much income for your whole farming operation. And so a lot of people say, "Well, I'd like to do organic. I can't afford to do that. I can't afford to go 3 years taking reduced income."
Yeah.
So I put an amendment in that allowed if you wanted to shift to organics and you would certify you're going to do this, you got a government subsidy for those 3 years
Nice.
during that period of time, so that there was, I wouldn't call it an incentive to become organic. But it took away the disincentive to become organic. And that
Yeah.
was my amendment that did that at that time.
I love hearing about the bills you propose because it always seems like these really interesting puzzles to solve and like such elegant ways of encouraging or discouraging certain behaviors. And I don't feel like I always see that same elegance nowadays in some of the bills to get passed. Well, shifting a little bit from the food that we eat to how we grow food, I was fortunate to be with you in Oklahoma City recently, where you received the highest award from the National Farmers Union, their Meritorious Service Award. And Aaron Lehman, the Iowa Farmers Union, had nominated you, and he's the president of the Iowa Farmers Union. And he gave a really nice opening to your talk, where he said that you are the grandfather of working conservation programs for farms, and he especially pointed out the Conservation Security Program. So I was wondering if you could say a little bit more about your work on conservation programs and farming, and how that came about, and what your vision was when you proposed some of this.
Well, yes, it was a great honor to receive that lifetime award from the National Farmers Union. I always felt very close to the Farmers Union all the years I was in office, and I think almost every year I received their annual award for stewardship, I guess you might say. So I was very honored to receive this lifetime award. I got interested in conservation. Well, when I first got on the Ag Committee, I represented Southwest Iowa in the Congress, and a lot of hilly land out there, and people were shifting at that time from cow-calf herds of grazing, that type of thing, to growing more corn and beans because that was the big push. But on hilly ground, that's highly erodible. So we began programs for things like building terraces, things like that to hold back. And so I became interested in that aspect of it. Plus, there was always a set-aside program during these farm bills. In other words, if you got in the program, you could set aside some of your land for conservation. You couldn't grow anything on it. Well, as the years went by, this happened in the 90s, we got more demand for more grain. And the WTO, the World Trade Organization, had basically fined, stipulated the United States was not following the agreement they had signed in the WTO in terms of subsidies. Well, but one of my colleagues in the Senate kept pointing out that Europe subsidized their farmers at a higher rate than we did, but they were WTO compliant, World Trade Organization compliant, so they weren't fined anything. Well, I became interested. How could that work? So I took my staff guy, Andy Fish, and I went to Europe, and we went to England and Belgium, the Netherlands, France, looking at agriculture and how were they able to give such high support for their farmers. Well, all of a sudden it dawned on me, the land there was beautiful, the water was clean, they had fence rows, wildlife. And here's the way they did it. They paid farmers not for what they grew and how much they grew. That was our system. We subsidized farmers for what they grew, program crops, and how much they grew. Over there, they said, no, we're going to pay farmers on how they grow it. Think about that. How they grow it. Are they keeping clean water? Are they stopping soil runoff? Are they good stewards of the land and keeping trees and fence rows and things like that? That's all WTO compliant. So I came back from that and I said, wait a minute. All of our conservation programs in the past were geared towards idling land, taking land out of production. But on the land you were producing, hey, up and down the hill you go, you know, and monoculture and throw on the nitrogen. I mean, there was nothing there to stimulate farmers to practice conservation on working lands. So that's what I did in the 2002 Farm Bill. I introduced the first conservation security program, which was structured to pay farmers, to give farmers support for how they grew things. And again, they tried to kill that. That was the same farm bill in which I got the fresh fruit and vegetable snack program in there. So I kept it alive, and then I got my chairmanship back in 2007, and then I really went to work on it and put a lot of money over a 10-year period into this program. And we changed the name of it from the Conservation Security Program to the Conservation Stewardship Program. Of course, how are you a steward? Are you a good steward of the land? That program is alive and well today, and it's the largest conservation program in America, and I'm very proud of it. And strangely enough, we don't have as much in Iowa as we have in some other states. I think we only have about 400 contracts in the state of Iowa. We could easily triple that, but again, a lot depends on who's running the NRCS, the Natural Resources and Conservation Service, how much they're pushing it, how they enroll farmers. Every farmer I've ever talked to that has been in the program think it's great because they have been able to get some good cost share money and support money for doing things like simple things like grass waterways, buffer strips, agreeing how much nitrogen you can put on and what time of the year. In other words, don't dump a bunch of nitrogen on your ground right before winter, for example. Do it in the spring and control how much you put on, not just dumping it on, but controlled. And people know we have good agronomists and others who can go out and take a look at your soil and your land and stuff and say, here should be your application rate for nitrogen. And if you adhere to that, then you're part of the Conservation Stewardship Program or crop rotations. or planting a cover crop. For example, we know full well that if you say harvest your combine your corn, let's say then you might run a disc over it or something like that, but then just plant a cover crop. Plant some winter cover crop over that. And it holds the soil in, doesn't blow away. Some of it actually fixes nitrogen in the soil. So that's all covered under the stewardship program. It encourages farmers to plant cover crops in the wintertime.
Yeah, that's great. A couple of things that makes me think of nitrates are such a huge issue, and we're going to talk more about those on the podcast in general. But just the past weekend, Des Moines Water Works asked people to stop watering their lawns because they were using so much energy to take out the nitrates from the water. It was high rates this time of year for them, and so they needed people to cut down on overall water use because it was costing them so much. And the other thing you made me think of is, so you recently got a tour of White Rock Conservancy from Liz Garst, and I had one of those too. And I don't know if we had identical tours, but on mine, she really did a great job of explaining when farmers are incentivized to plant on land that isn't good quality land, it has bad consequences for ecology. And it's also just not even very cost effective. It's just the government is giving them money, so they plant there, but it wouldn't be worth it otherwise in many cases.
That's
So,
right.
yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yes, I just took that tour of White Rock Conservancy. Liz Garst and their family have done a fantastic job there, and it's a showcase for the way agriculture should be done. If you're not, or they're not organic, but that's okay. Not everybody should be organic, but they then in their way they do their cropping is very conserving, and they do cover crops on maybe not all the land, but a lot of it. They do winter cover crops. I forget, maybe winter rye or something like that. I forget what it was that they use, and they can actually graze cattle on that too at the same time. No, they do. It's a great operation. It's a good showcase. I just, in fact, interesting, before we're doing this podcast, I just had lunch with the head of the West Des Moines Water Board. Actually, I didn't know he was the head of the West Des Moines Water Board. He's an old friend of mine. And he was telling me the very same thing you just mentioned about how they've asked people in West Des Moines to cut down their watering by one-fourth, a 25% cut. And he said, and it's because of this, because they buy water from Des Moines, and because of the cost of the nitrates, removing the, and he said, it's not only the cost, they can't remove it. They've only got so many filters. So they can't run the water through as rapidly as people need it. So it's not just the cost. They just don't have the filters to do it because there's so much nitrate in nitrogen in that water. And he said, they're thinking that maybe they may have to go to mandatory. They might have to pass stuff there to say you can't water your lawns on Monday, Wednesday, Friday, or that type of thing.
Sure, people will love that.
Well, and Liz Garst and I, we had a great discussion about this and about nitrogen runoff, and a couple of things that have happened in terms of the way water runs off of soil now. But the other thing that's happened, and I need to talk about a lot, and that is the tiling that we've done in Iowa. When I was a kid, my dad laid tile, farm tile, and they did it by hand. They dug these trenches out.
Oh, wow.
They used red clay tiles, and they would set them in there. They didn't cement them together. They just laid them in, and that's the way the water got in, the cracks from one tile to the other. Very inefficient and very labor intensive. Well, as the years went by, someone invented a plastic water pipe tile, continuous. It got holes in it. It's round, black, about maybe, what, 6 inches in diameter, maybe a little bit more. And a big machine that just goes through the land and digs this trench. They can dig a trench that for a certain given distance, it would have taken my dad and others probably a week or two to dig. They can do it in a day. So it just digs that trench. They put that water pipe in there and it's done, and they cover it up. And that water pipe is hugely efficient. The old clay tiles would plug up a little bit. They didn't drain all the best. These tiles could drain everything. And so when you put that nitrogen on and you have a heavy rain and water, it goes right down into that tile, shoots into the ditches, into your streams, down the Mississippi River
Right.
and Des Moines, down the Des Moines and down the Raccoon and Des Moines rivers, and causes all kinds of problems. So while tiling was good, the advancement in how to tile and kind of tiling, I don't think has been much of a real blessing, quite frankly. Now, again, if we control the amount of nitrogen we use and when it's applied, it could work better. And if we have better buffer strips and waterways and things like that, but people just put on too much nitrogen at the wrong times.
Yeah, we've lost that natural filtration system of the water making its way slowly through the ground.
That's right. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, thinking about the overall agricultural landscape, what do you see as some of the most urgent public health challenges that stem from the way that we grow food today?
Well, I think from a public health standpoint is what kind of chemicals are we putting on in massive proportions on land all over America? People have been just pouring Roundup on for years and years and years. And well, they say it degrades all that kind of stuff. But, there's now new evidence that maybe Roundup's not as safe as people thought it was. And a lot of it sits there and accumulates, even though they say it deteriorates, but they're not so certain about that either. And that's a herbicide. Then there's the pesticides that are either sprayed by aircraft or by tanks on back of tractors. Some of those pesticides can be pretty damaging too, health-wise. And some of them are longer lived. Now, we did get rid of DDT. Well, that was terrible. But they came up with other chemicals to control pests. And what we found is that when you start applying things like that, it keeps the pests down. But then the pests develop immunities to it. They know how to overcome it. And so you put on more pesticide. Well, and then you jiggle the formula a little bit. To me, that is a big public health hazard in America today, and we have not addressed it adequately. I think on the other side of the coin on public health is, as we covered in the beginning of this podcast, how do we encourage more rational use of water and soil to grow things that people actually eat? Not number two yellow corn that is ground up and fed to chickens, so we have more fried chicken, or fed to cattle, so we have more hamburger. But how, I mean, food that we actually eat. And I think that's also another public health problem, in that we're using the land, the soil, the water to grow things that are made into ultra processed foods. And I don't think that, I think that's also a public health problem.
Yeah, that reminds me. Last September, we had a conference. You had worked with Dr. Jim Merchant from University of Iowa in the past, and he had a co-edited book that came out on industrial farm animal production and public health and the environment. And we had a 2-day conference I thought was fantastic, but I was wondering if you had any takeaways from that conference. And you wrote the foreword to the book, I should mention.
Well, listen, Adam, thanks for bringing that up. But yes, a public health hazard are CAFOs, confined animal feeding operations. They are a health hazard, not only for the people that work there and take care of these confinement, these big, long buildings that have thousands of hogs in one place or tens of thousands of chickens in one place, some cattle, but mostly hogs and chickens and turkeys. And of course, you have two health hazards there. One is the excrement, the manure that comes off. Where does that go? It's not being treated. I think we have four times as many hogs in Iowa as people. Well, where does all of that hog manure go? For humans, we treat it in disposal systems and waste systems, not hog manure. Oh, so think about that. Four times as many. Well, what if we had four times as many people in Iowa and we didn't have any sanitary sewers or sanitary disposal systems? That's another health hazard from confinement animal feeding operation. The other part of the hazard of those are the airborne stuff, because these places aren't totally enclosed. They're open to the atmosphere. They put out terrible odors that are in themselves harmful. And then the airborne particles that drift for miles that people breathe from these confined animal feeding operations. Well, I'm glad you mentioned that. That's another terrible health hazard, not only here, but in a lot of different places in America.
Yeah, for sure. I hear a lot about North Carolina, definitely with the hog CAFO.
Well, there's a book I recommend to people a lot, and it's called Wastelands.
Oh,
That's the
yeah.
name of the book, Wastelands. There's a foreword by John Grisham, Grisham the novelist, saying he wished he'd written that book.
Wow.
It's a fantastic book, Wastelands, and it's about cases that were brought for small farmers in North Carolina that were overrun by the confinement feeding operations, and what it did to their health, and what it did to the whole health aspect of huge communities in that area. I recommend it highly. It's a fascinating book, Wastelands.
Yeah, thank you. That's great. And your earlier comment about the airborne particles, we'll definitely want to explore that more in the podcast in the future. But it made me think it's a case of don't believe your lying nose, right? It smells like there's something wrong with these CAFOs. And we were told, oh, don't worry about it. That's the smell of money. But it turns out as more and more research comes out, it's not quite
Don't
that.
believe your asthma and your watery eyes and your runny noses and your colds that you get. Now, don't believe all that. Thank you for doing these podcasts. Again, this is reaching out to Iowans and others. That's a way of being a part of the Institute. Our founding document is to connect people to policy. And you connect people to policy by adequately informing people and giving them the kind of access to the information that we have discussed here on this podcast. So thanks for doing this.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Senator. It's always a great pleasure to speak with you. So I really appreciate it.
We'll see you at the next symposium.
That's it for this week's episode of Canary in a Cornfield. Stay tuned for future episodes where we're going to talk about nitrates in drinking water, other impacts of pesticides, impacts of CAFOs, avian influenza, which is still here, and many other ways in which agriculture connects to public health. Just a reminder, you can find us on social media, on X, on Facebook, Instagram, and TikTok, and find our webpage at harkininstitute.drake.edu. And this podcast is hosted by Substack at Canary in a Cornfield. So thank you all for tuning in, and I will be talking with you soon.